Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good morning, Ramona Koval here with a book show on ABC Radio National. Did you know the spice trade was really a luxury trade that inspired all sorts of imperial missions that changed the course of world history? In his book, Out of the East, Spices and the Medieval Imagination, Paul Friedman looks at the demand for spices, how they were used, who used them, and how they drove the commerce and exploration of the era. So a very spicy book show, very shortly. And in our first person reading, more from Paul Theroux's book, Dark Star Safari, an account of an overland journey he made through Africa. As you take that piece of cinnamon cake to enjoy with your morning coffee and suck that morsel of crystallised ginger, have a think about what you might have been doing if you'd been listening to the book show in early medieval Europe, assuming the radio and the internet had already been invented. Well, you can forget about the cinnamon and ginger for a start. Paul Friedman is Chester D. Tripp Professor of History at Yale University. His previous books include Images of the Medieval Peasant and The Origins of Peasant Servitude in Medieval Catalonia. And the new one is called Out of the East, Spices and the Medieval Imagination. He joins us now from a studio rather north of us in New York. Welcome to the book show, Paul.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Paul, if we were sitting down to a meal before the spice trade brought all these wonderful things to medieval Europe, what would the food be like? What would we be eating?
If we were rich enough, we would have maybe some spices, basic spices like pepper. In the Roman Empire, we would have a lot of the food flavored with some rather unusual herbs, including one called silphium that came from North Africa. The Romans loved this so much that, in fact, they ate all of it. It's extinct.
What did they say it tasted like?
Well, there's some debate about that, and it's hard to reconstruct. It had a kind of sourish taste. It looks like it was replaced by asafoetida, which is still sometimes used in Indian cuisine. Maybe it's a little like fenugreek, but it was more like an herb.
So like a
it's
dill something that or something.
Even a little more sour and a little more, I guess you might think, off. They loved fish paste as well as a flavoring. But really the advent of the things we associate as edible spices, the ginger that you mentioned, nutmeg, really comes in the 11th and 12th centuries.
You put pay to this idea very early on in the book that the reason why spices were so sought after was because there was a whole lot of rotting meat around that needed to be preserved at least or its horrible taste taken away. Explain why that's a silly thing to think.
Well, there are many better ways to preserve meat and more inexpensive than coating it with spices. If you salt meat, dry it, pickle it, smoke it, all of these are effective ways of dealing with a surplus of meat before the age of refrigeration. So, you know, if you kill a pig in the fall, you can't eat it all at once. You want it to last until the summer. Salting would be the most common in those other methods I mentioned. So to use spices, which are incredibly expensive, to preserve meat would be, as I mentioned in the book, a little bit like slicing white Italian truffles, you know, that go for like $1,000 US a pound in order to jazz up a fast food hamburger. It's just an inappropriate imbalance of expenses.
And besides that, there was apparently a lot of fresh meat around everywhere.
There's more than we think. We tend to assume that, this was sort of rare and that what meat there was would spoil very quickly. And we have lots and lots of complaints about cattle in people's backyards. There are animals everywhere. And if you had enough money to afford spices, you had enough money to afford fresh meat pretty much whenever you wanted.
All right. So the question about what made them so valuable and what made them so sought after is not to be found in that particular idea. Tell me, I was pretty surprised that sugar was considered a spice, and granulated sugar that we use every day for cooking wasn't available. When did that come into being?
Well, sugar comes through the Muslim world and is one of these things that's not known in the Roman Empire but is very big in the Middle Ages. It's a spice rather than the staple that it became really after about 1700 in Europe, in the sense that it's used with other spices. It's used as a garnish. So, for example, the early pasta recipes call for Parmesan cheese, as you would have now, but also cinnamon and sugar to accompany pasta.
So it's used with other spices. What about desserts? So no desserts before that? Desserts only sort of steeped in honey rather than whipping up your egg whites and adding sugar to them to make wonderful sort of concoctions?
Well, you put your finger on a kind of interesting difference between the Middle Ages and now. We make a big difference between savory and sweet, and we tend not to like to have sugar, say, with fish or with meat, except in some exceptional, like, sweet and sour circumstances. In the Middle Ages, the dessert could be things like fried pork meatballs. It could also be crystallized sugar with spices in it, or maybe both. So for one thing, they have sugar in every course of the meal, in the soup, in the fish, in the meat. It's used along with cinnamon or cloves, which we would consider also more sweet and more appropriate for desserts. So their desserts would be disappointing. On the other hand, they're very big on what would be the ancestor of candies, these things like sugar shaped in, like little chess pieces and with different spices enclosed in them and, eaten, crunched up in like peanut brittle or something like that.
So but before they got the sugar, presumably they couldn't make a sponge cake.
No. They certainly had a diet, and honey is not nearly as sweet as sugar. They had a diet that, by our standards, we would be starved for sweetness. And it's not surprising, then, that once sugar comes in, it's wildly popular. And once it starts being cultivated in great, huge plantations after the discovery of the New World, then European consumption goes up astronomically. The average person in Britain now consumes literally 100 times what a well-off person in the Middle Ages would have consumed annually.
Well, talking of consumption, they were very, very fond of meat and they didn't like vegetables and they liked their spices completely mixed up together, like the more the merrier.
That's right. In the mixing up of spices then, it's not that you, for example, put cinnamon on French toast or maybe have cloves with ham. It's more like the Middle East or Indonesia or other parts of East Asia where you have combinations of spices. The recipes call for various mixtures of 8 spices or 10 spices, something like curry powder. And that's very characteristic of medieval cuisine.
You've got a 14th century recipe requiring lampreys to be eviscerated while still alive. Their blood's then drained into red wine for 2 hours to produce a sauce. And then you add pepper, ginger, cloves, something called grains of paradise, mace, and lots of sugar.
That's right. Doesn't sound very appetizing, perhaps, by modern standards. But they loved big fish or big fish-like creatures. Lampreys are big eels, and they are an Atlantic and then have a freshwater cycle. And they have to be killed in a certain way in order for them to taste good. They also were considered to be dangerous in the Middle Ages. All eels were, but lampreys particularly were thought to be excessively moist and cold. And so they had to be countered by something with the opposite properties of hot and dry. So you're supposed to have lamprey with a lot of pepper and a lot of other spices as well, and sugar, as you point out. And it had to be drowned in red wines. There's a whole ritual associated with it. Fabulously expensive, very highly prized. Again, an example of something where I'm not sure that modern tastes are in sync. But the one place in Europe where they still eat a lot of lamprey is Bordeaux. There's a Lamproie à la Bordelaise is still a very prized dish, and you still have to basically kill the lamprey in red wine.
Well, I'm speaking with Paul Friedman, who's a historian at Yale University, and he's written this book called Out of the East, Spices and the Medieval Imagination, and we're on the book show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval. So, Paul, what about this extraordinary description of the musicians in the pie from a medieval feast? Tell me about that, because it, of course, occurs to me that there's a little song about that. 4 and 20 blackbirds.
Well, the thing about medieval dining, at least aristocratic and royal dining, is that it's really kind of vulgar. In the United States, I guess the closest parallels would be certain kinds of big weddings or Las Vegas. Spectacle's very important. And trying to do things that are almost impossible, like having a pie with musicians inside. These things include not only edible courses where you, for example, have a castle with various animals on its battlements and the animals are breathing fire. The animals may be made out of edible bean paste or just be things like huge lobsters with camphor wicks attached to them so that they seem to be breathing fire as if they were dragons. But then you also have things called entremets, which are like a kind of a little ballet intermezzo between courses where you have, fountains in allegorical forms spouting different kinds of wines, or a tableau of the Crusaders attacking Jerusalem, or boats sailing in a kind of artificial lake, or the pies with the musicians.
Now I want to know how do you cook a pie with musicians in it? Presumably they get in afterwards. There's a little trapdoor in the back, and they come in and
trap
sneak
door
in
on the bottom,
and
I think. Yeah, and you probably have like a grid, kind of like those geodesic domes where you've got a kind of a wooden lattice work, and you put your dough on it and
bake it.
Well, you probably bake the dough in sections and then attach it.
And then you get your musicians.
There's not an oven
in.
Big enough to get your musicians.
Those musicians, they don't
cook
well.
Or you get your birds in and you close the trap door and then you wheel the pie out as the birds struggle.
And when the pie's open, the birds begin to sing. And wasn't that a dainty dish, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. Or you have cooked blackbirds in the pie and then you've got one live one so that you have
a decoy.
Right. But, wasn't that long ago that there were sort of, a certain kind of businessman's fates would involve girls jumping out of pies or various kinds of dubious performances. This would be medieval as well. I think we erroneously think that this was an age of purely religious interests. It most certainly had a lot of different interests apart from religion.
Well, I am getting really, very much stuck on these meals, but they are fun to talk about. And I will get back to the spices in a minute. What about a medieval meal? You couldn't go past having peacocks and dolphins as well.
That's right. As I said earlier, Ramona, they're very big on large fishes, fish like sturgeons or things they thought were fish like dolphins or porpoises or whale or eels. Whale is found on menus, particularly in northwestern Europe.
And so the whole idea that, medieval notables are standing around with their sort of spit-roasted carcasses, pulling them off, from their tearing them limb from limb from the dead animal, that's not it. They like making their dishes look like other things.
Yeah, they are very sophisticated, but they're kind of show-offs. And so they love having trompe l'oeil, something where it looks like a peacock, or it's a partridge dressed in peacock, or it's fish used to make something look like it's wild boar, or where you have a fish that's still whole, but it's been cooked three different ways and colored three different colors. So anything that is spectacular, brightly colored.
And what colors? Tell us the colors. Like, we're talking about really big colors, aren't we?
Well, they love gold, and so in some banquet orders, we have surprising quantities of gold leaf to be pounded very thin, and there's this kind of edible gold where you can cover for example, wild boar's head, where the one half of the boar's head is covered with gold, and the other half is covered with a parsley sauce. So you have a green and gold boar's head. This is one famous recipe.
I'm surprised they even used parsley because, I mean, it was sort of vegetable-like, wasn't it? And they didn't go for it.
Well, it's an herb. It's okay. Better maybe, more prestigious would be cameline sauce, which is so-called because it's camel-colored. It's basically cinnamon and five or six of those other spices like the grains of paradise that you mentioned before. This is a kind of peppery spice that actually comes from Africa, as it turns out. They thought came from India or maybe from paradise itself, the Garden of Eden.
So they had this idea that raw fruit was bad for you.
They were very afraid of rotting. They have this obsession with food not being digested and therefore rotting in the stomach. And so raw fruit, again, like lamprey, is too cold and too moist. Dried fruit is great and fine, and they get this from the Muslim, Arab, Persian world as well, via Spain particularly. Ordinary people, peasants, maybe middle-class people, enjoyed the fruit of the season, but the upper classes tended to mistrust it, or their doctors told them to mistrust it. Sometimes, of course, as happens now, people listened to their doctor's advice, fussed about their doctor's advice, and then proceeded to do what they want, often in defiance of that advice. So in the Renaissance, particularly, melon became incredibly popular, even though physicians warned that of all fruits, it was the worst in terms of this rotting in your stomach fear. The doctors finally prevailed on people to accompany it with something salty so that it would be countered by a hot and dry ingredient, caviar and melon, or eventually prosciutto and melon.
Oh, yeah.
We get the combination of prosciutto and melon really from medical advice. Salty ham will offset the evil effects of the fruit. We think of these as naturally going together, but if you actually consider it, there's not an obvious kinship between ham and melon.
Now, I just thought to myself, didn't they sort of think about, people in the state of nature and going around picking fruit off trees and thinking, well, obviously it didn't kill them because that's all they had at the time. Why would it be so feared?
Well, they don't have quite so evolutionary or anthropological a view. Part of it is that maybe in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve simply lived off of various trees and various fruit.
And look what happened to Eve.
Exactly. Look what happened. And after that happened, in our fallen state now, we have to go out and kill animals. We can't live that way. We can't live in a kind of a paradise of light meals that we gather in the forest. We've got to go out and actually spill blood and kill animals, get fish through various devious and laborious means, and food is difficult. Some of it is taste, however. As you pointed out earlier, the upper class really has a very high protein diet. The upper class likes meat and fish and sugar and spices, and is not enthusiastic about dairy products and rather despises vegetables. In terms of balance and balanced diet, the lower classes, provided they actually had enough to eat, had a much more nutritious regime than the upper classes, whose caloric intake and protein intake would now strike us as just extraordinary.
Yeah, apparently, you said a banquet to celebrate the enthronement of George Neville as Archbishop of York in 1465 allowed for 10 kilos of well-spiced meat per person.
Yes, it went on for a few days, to be sure. But what's striking about these kinds of banquet menus of the highest aristocracy is that each course seems to be meat, or if it's a fast day, fish. But the variety of species is quite amazing, so that they have they make up in variety of different kinds of animals. Birds and fish particularly, things that we just either don't get because, you know, the environmentally degraded environment that we have prohibits, you know, the use of them, or we just don't like them anymore, particularly all sorts of little birds, bitterns, curlews, ortolans, larks, huge quantities of quails, partridges, various varieties of partridges, and then also very big birds that I think we don't consider to be completely edible now, heron, swan, things like that. They're very big on those.
Well, you mentioned the doctors. I should just say we're speaking about Out of the East, Spices and the Medieval Imagination with Paul Friedman on the book show here on ABC Radio National. Doctors and chefs had a big conversation going, didn't they? Because doctors, as you said, said we should avoid raw fruit and that kind of thing. But spices were used as drugs, indeed also as aphrodisiacs. Tell us about the use of spices for the healing arts.
Well, spices had the great advantage of being not only delicious and prestigious, but they were thought to be of medicinal value, so that you have a kind of situation, the closest parallel of which might be something like aromatherapy, the idea that fragrance is kind of a virtuous thing and a healing thing in itself. So spices were important for balancing food in terms of the theory of the humors, that is, these hot, cold, moist, dry qualities we were talking about before. Spices were also in themselves drugs or medicine. Every edible spice that we know of today, cloves, nutmeg, were found in lists of drugs, pharmaceutical manuals. And then there are some things that are fragrant that we wouldn't associate with food that were considered incredibly powerful drugs and regarded as spices because of their fragrance. Things like ambergris, which is a fragrance that comes from sperm whales.
From sperm whale vomit, actually, isn't it?
Well, it's actually it's an effluvia, but it's not vomit. It's not from the digestive system. It's a kind of it's something produced by certain kinds of whales in response to an irritation. So it's not quite that bad, but it is from the guts of the whale. Yes,
all right.
Indeed.
All right.
Or camphor, which comes from one particular tree that was native to Indonesia, particularly to Kalimantan, or musk from a certain kind of deer, mastic, which comes from a particular plant that grows only on one Greek island in the Aegean. So all of these fragrances, resins or animal substances, were thought to either singly or in combination have extremely powerful healing and preventive powers, and preventive in the sense that if you burned them or smelled them, held them close to your nose in times of plague, for example, they would ward off the miasmas or the bad air that was thought to cause disease.
So in fact, spice merchants were apothecaries of the time.
It's very hard to tell the difference between someone who is selling edible spices and an apothecary who is, in effect, selling medicinal spices. The frontier between medicine and food was pretty soft.
So now let's talk about the spice roots then, because we've established beyond a doubt the importance of spices in this time and the thirst for them and the fascination with them. Where did they come from and how did they get there?
Well, they actually came from more places than the Europeans realized. The Europeans at the time thought they all came from India. They weren't exactly sure where India was other than it was in the east. They thought it was probably next to the Garden of Eden. They often placed it at the extreme east. It was realized that some spices came from even further east of India. One of Marco Polo's contributions in around 1300 was to report that there were islands east of India, particularly Indonesian islands, where nutmeg and cloves came from, and that these were shipped to India to reach Europe. Marco Polo also identified China as the source of some exotic products. There was a certain diversity of where things actually came from. But what interested me a lot was the Europeans' idea of the East, not so much their accurate ideas, but their inaccurate ones, their ideas of the exotic or of the East as being somehow richer, more beautiful, the source of things like spices that were not only prized consumer products, but that had a certain kind of spiritual value as well. So there's a sense of the East as exotic, but also a sense of the East as better, more powerful, closer to the source of goodness in the world, and even the idea that somehow the people of India were actually Christian and they were ruled over by Christian kings becomes a powerful idea in Europe related to this really lust for spices.
So the spice routes across the Indian subcontinent and through Central Asia, these are moderated by Arabs?
They are moderated by Muslims of different sort. In Central Asia, more by Turkic peoples. The seaborne trade that sometimes dominated over the Central Asian land route that would bring spices up the Red Sea to Egypt or up the Persian Gulf into what's now Iraq and Iran. These were certainly dominated more by Arabs, but often there were different kind of middlemen from Gujaratis in India to various Malay and other peoples in further east, from the European point of view, until the voyages of Da Gama and Columbus, the people that the Europeans bought the spices from were usually Muslim, almost 90% of the cases Muslim, and this irritated some of the strategists of European commerce.
Do we know what the Muslims thought of this sort of sudden interest in the spices from the Europeans?
Well, the Europeans were only one part of a kind of global trade in spices. When Marco Polo says that in China they import 100,000 times more pepper than Venice does, this is probably not quite accurate, but it is an indication of the balance. So it's not so much that Europeans were unique in wanting spices, but that the Muslim traders made it their business to try and prevent the Europeans from dealing directly with the source of spices.
And how did they make it their business?
Well, they could, in effect, prevent the Europeans from getting out of the Mediterranean into the Red Sea. Europeans, for example, at one point tried to build a base in what's now Eilat in Israel in order to be able to bypass Egypt, and Saladin pretty quickly put an end to that. So when you have the opening up of the land route because of the Mongols, the Europeans are able to deal directly with Asia, but still not so much with the real centers of the spices. There are a few European merchants who managed to make it across the Himalayas into India, for example, but they don't figure out the sea route to India, of course, until the end of the Middle Ages. And once they figure that out, then the the Portuguese begin the European colonial adventure in Asia, and the balance of power is pretty dramatically changed.
Well, of course, these great expeditions of the end of the 15th century were launched by the desire for spices, and including Columbus.
That's right. And what interested me was not only the trade in spices, but where that desire came from. Why was that desire so strong as to fuel such insanely risky ventures as those of Da Gama and Columbus? You know, ventures that you had no more than a 50-50 chance of surviving. And you'd have to really be sure that if you made it, your profits would be huge to undertake a risk like that. And that's what kind of interested me and motivated me in writing this book.
So, I mean, how do we explain this? Is it like the sense of the gold rush or the tulip mania that we've read about, or, you know, the dot-com craze of more recent times?
Partly, yes. It's partly a kind of image rather than a need. And one of the things that's important to realize is that the world of commerce is fueled not only on things that are necessities or perceived necessities like petroleum, but on non-necessities, on affordable luxuries, on consumer products that may even seem frivolous or somewhat pointless. Certain kinds of beverages like Coca-Cola, you know, achieve an international kind of celebrity at a certain point, even though no one could call them necessities. And then the other thing is that the desire for these things generates the possibility of profits. And when you think that you can get the profits into your own hands and that the commodity itself is really common, then it's worth the risks. In other words, if the Europeans had thought that spices were really rare in India and that they cost almost the same in India, like, to get back to white truffles in Italy, are expensive because there are only a few of them, then it's not worth the risk of, disease, death, and sort of horrible long voyages. But if you think that the spices are really common, then it's worth the trip.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it? So how did these voyages affect the known geography of the world?
Well, particularly it led to competing theories about where India was in relation to Europe. And a little bit what many of us, you know, had to sort of slog through in secondary school is true. There's a theory that the world is actually rather small, and if you sail west of Europe, you will hit the eastern islands of Asia, either Indonesia or Japan or coastal China, pretty quickly. The competing theory was that you could go around Africa, even though some of the Greek geographers said there wasn't an all-water route around Africa. The Portuguese eventually figured out that there was, and that by then sailing east rather than west, you could reach India via the Indian Ocean. So some of this is commerce and knowledge, geography following commercial expansion. Some of it is, of course, inaccurate geographical knowledge. And that spurred as much advance in its own way, unpredictable to be sure, as accurate knowledge. It's not just a question of people learning and then assimilating their new knowledge. Like the dot-com boom, like the tulip mania, the exaggerated ideas of wealth, the false but alluring belief in riches just around the corner, the El Dorado myths are equally as important in leading to progress, global connections, as are accurate forms of information.
They developed a moral critique of the use of spices. People sort of thought that they were bad for you eventually, didn't they?
Well, morally bad, certainly. There was something disturbing right from the start about spending inordinate amounts of money on something that's an ephemeral pleasure. You know, gold is something that is associated with vice as well, but at least it's a durable thing. There is, as always happens with gourmandise, the idea that all this labor went into making this lamprey or making this fish cooked three ways, and then the thing is consumed in a matter of minutes and, you know, excrete it out of the body. So how can this be worthwhile? How can people give all this energy to something so frivolous, spend all this money on something so ephemeral?
Well, it's fetishization, isn't it?
Well, very much so. And, of course, we're familiar with some of these same kind of critiques of luxury in the first place, of ephemeral luxury, and of luxury that flaunts ostentatiously wealth in the face of the poor. And this was certainly strong in a society that had lots of poor people and in which spices were one gesture of showing wealth as opposed to the prevailing kind of scrimping and frugality.
And, of course, they became less rare, less exotic, and they really did fall out of fashion, didn't they?
Slowly, but already in the 15th century, pepper is thought to be really for peasants. And although it continued to be eaten in large quantities by the upper classes, it sort of does fall out of the cookbooks because, you know, now anybody can afford it. It's no longer, it becomes, you know, a little bit too readily available.
I mean, now, you know, salt and pepper is just, you know, the boring bit that you add, and then you had to think, you have to think of something really delicious. What about the way you cook, Paul? How do you cook? Are you a great spice man?
I think I am in the sense of, like a lot of Americans, I like piquant things. I like to make Mexican food. I love Chinese food. I have a small repertoire of dishes that I know how to make. But the spices that I like tend to be peppery spices, things like chili peppers. And chili peppers are not a medieval spice, more a New World spice.
What about, you know, you remember we talked about that Roman spice that the Romans ate up completely, the one that came from the north of Africa. What are the ones that you would like to taste that you haven't done that? You haven't tried the lamprey yet, presumably.
Right, I haven't tried the lamprey. I'm really quite keen on that and plan to make it my business to do that.
Ortolans, are you going to eviscerate it live?
I think I'll have someone else do that, but I do want to try this lamprey à la bordelaise. I tend to be, I suppose, gastronomically squeamish, but quite willing to eat something as long as somebody else has kind of dealt with the nasty part.
And in the pursuit of your research, of course.
Naturally. This is all, you know, part of my academic mission.
And how will you have your dolphin?
I'm not sure.
On toast?
Yeah, maybe sushi form. Well, toast is a good idea. I hadn't thought of that. Maybe with little white truffles.
Okay.
They love truffles in the Middle Ages, too.
Delicious. Look, you've made us all, our mouths water, probably, kind of.
Well, except it's
for
almost
the,
time for lunch.
The whale vomit.
Are,
yes, well, it's nearly morning tea time. So, look, Paul, thank you so much for talking to us on The Book Show.
Thank you, Ramon. It's been a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And the book is called Out of the East, Spices and the Medieval Imagination. It's published by Yale University Press. And I've been speaking with Paul Friedman, who's Chester D. Tripp Professor of History at Yale University. But you're on The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval. Next on The Book Show, Alexander Heyman's a genius, or at least the American MacArthur Foundation thinks so. He won one of the organization's famed genius grants in 2004 to fund research for his latest book, The Lazarus Project, which is an exploration of immigrant identity. And the book is about a writer creating a book about immigrant identity thanks to a special grant. It's confusing, but it's marvellous, and so is he. Alexander Heyman, later on today after 10 a.m. Remember, you can hear this program again by going to the website and the address, abc.net.au/rn/bookshow, where you can download us as a podcast, and you can find today's guest and book details there too. That's all from me, Ramona Koval, on ABC Radio National. Time now for the news.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.